Hi, and welcome to Ladies Who Love Bomb, where we talk with amazing women spreading positive change in this kind of crazy world. In each episode, our guest will tell you how to create change too. I'm your host, Jill Hilbrenner, and my guest today is Teresa Lee. She's a classical pianist who was one of the people to inspire Senator Dick Durbin to introduce the DREAM Act back in 2001. It would have created a path for certain people who came to the U.S. undocumented as children to become legal residents. Teresa came to the States at age 2, but was born in Brazil, where her South Korean parents had fled after the Korean War. She spent much of her childhood in Chicago, afraid that she and her parents would get deported to 2 separate continents. Now, Teresa's world looks very different. She's created a new life in New York City, where she's an advocate for immigration reform. Teresa, thank you so much for joining today.
Hi.
So, you moved to Chicago when you were 2, Teresa. What was your childhood like growing up in Chicago?
Well, we came here with nothing. My parents, we were very poor, and they found a basement to live in a very gang-infested neighborhood. And so whenever it rained, for example, it would flood every time, and we lived with bugs and mice, and we didn't have any furniture. And we were in Chicago, as cold as a winter. We didn't have any coats, or, you know, there was no hot water or heat. But that was the way I thought life was.
Wow.
We didn't grow up with toys or TV or, you know, it was just what was around us was how we lived. That was just how we lived.
I know you have a brother, but how old were you when he was born?
I was 3 when he was born.
When and how did you discover that you and your parents were living in Chicago undocumented?
It was about when I was 7 years old. I learned that I was undocumented. My dad sat the family around in the living room, and he said, "I have something very important to tell you, and this is very serious, and you must not tell anybody else, even your closest friends or your teachers, or if anybody asks you about it, don't say anything. Just don't say anything. Close your mouth and be silent." And that was that we were undocumented. And at that point, at that age, I didn't understand what it really meant to be undocumented, except that we would be separated. That's how my dad explained it to us, that I would be sent to Brazil because I was born there. And my little brother was born in Chicago. So he would be put in foster care somewhere in Chicago. And my parents would be sent away to Korea, where they were from. So that kind of fear was embedded in our lives since I was 7.
That seems really traumatic, because what you've described as far as growing up just in the neighborhood where you were already seems difficult enough. And then to get this knowledge as well, thinking about what that would mean for your family to be separated, I just can't imagine processing that at age 7.
Yes, absolutely. And that fear, you know, it's constant. Even when we're in our apartment under a roof with closed doors, you just never knew who was going to knock on the door.
Yeah. And so for a little bit of background, you were born in Brazil, but your parents were Korean. So can you explain what led them to end up moving to Brazil back in the day?
Absolutely. Just like any other migrants, because of hardship, because of war, because of the aftermath of destructions of the Korean War, my parents were part of the thousands of other migrants to South America at that time. And I was born in Brazil, and my parents opened a clothing business, and they were doing pretty well until they got robbed completely, and they had to start all over. They had no money left. My mother sold her wedding ring and some jewelry, and she bought plane tickets and visas. And that's when we came to the U.S. with a visa.
It's just crazy to think about the turn of events, right? Because I think you know, just with the dialogue that we're having today. And just to be clear, I don't think this way. And I know a lot of people don't think this way, but you get the stories that are like, oh, you know, people are moving because they want to take jobs and all this sort of really heated rhetoric. But you think about how many things actually have to happen to put someone in a position where they're willing to uproot their lives and move. And it's, you know, I don't think anybody does this because they're like, oh, I want to become a graphic designer or I'd like to work in tech or something. It's just,
absolutely.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. So your story with Senator Durbin goes back to 2001. What was happening at the time and how did your story come to his attention?
I'll backtrack just a little bit more. And my dad was a pastor of a church, and there was a piano. And I would practice the church piano from time to time. And there was a wealthy church member that was very grateful to my dad for his ministry and saw that we didn't have any furniture and saw how poorly we were living. And she donated some money for furniture, including upright Kauai piano. And that's when I started playing the piano, practicing the piano a lot in my home. I had some help from local piano teachers, but we couldn't really afford piano lessons. I was able to find Merritt School of Music in Chicago that took me in and gave me a scholarship to study the piano and take private lessons there. And a year after I started taking lessons, I won a big competition. I got to perform with the Chicago Symphony Orchestra playing the Tchaikovsky Piano Concerto. And it was a big deal because I was the first inner city student to have won that competition. So I started getting some recognition from representatives and congress members from Illinois. And my teachers started asking me what colleges I was planning on applying to, because I was at that age, I was 16 years old. And I said, I'm not applying to any colleges because I was undocumented. I didn't tell them yet that I was undocumented. I had the notion that because I was undocumented, colleges wouldn't accept me. And that was very true at that time. The colleges didn't accept you if you didn't have Social Security numbers. And so the artistic director of Merritt School of Music at that time was Anne Monaco. She proceeded to print out 10 application forms for me and just gave it to me and forced me to fill them out and said, bring them back to me the next day. So I did. I brought them back to her and I filled them
You're
out
a good
as
student.
Much as I could. I'm obedient. and she saw my application form and she noticed that I said I was born in Brazil. And she was confused. Noticed that the Social Security number space was blank. I knew that we didn't have a Social Security number. And I brought it right back to her the next day. And she said, why is this still blank? I broke into tears. I was hysterical. And I told her that actually, we don't have a Social Security number. We're undocumented. And please don't report us to the police because I don't want to be responsible for separating my family.
And what was her response to you? What did she say? What did she do?
Well, she didn't know what to say then, but she said, okay, I'll look into this. And the next day, I saw her again. I was practicing every day at Merritt School of Music at this time. I was a practicing maniac. I was practicing the piano sometimes 10 hours a day.
Oh, my gosh.
There was nobody else more than Anne Monaco at that time. And so she said, we're going to do this. And we contacted Senator Durbin's office. And Senator Durbin's office looked into my case, and they saw that There was nothing that they could do. There was no remedy as of yet. According to the law, I would have to be deported to Brazil right now.
Oh, my gosh.
And so we even tried to go the route of getting an office visa because I had just won that big competition. I was becoming an established pianist, sort of, teen pianist. And if I had gone ahead with the office visa, I would have been deported. I was at a dead end.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only answer was that Senator Durbin had to write a personal bill for me. So he wrote a personal bill on behalf of me so that I can be on a pathway to citizenship, after the citizenship. And we were so excited, and this was going to pass. And some other students approached Senator Durbin and said, I'm also undocumented, like Theresa Lee. Can you write a personal bill for me? And he realized that he needed to redraft this bill to a larger bill, the DREAM Act.
What were your parents and your family saying as all of this was going on?
Well, we were very nervous. We were all very nervous, but we were also prepared to become separated. Sad, but true.
The main objective, right, is to, what? Maybe let me ask it this way. What's the main objective of the DREAM Act?
The main objective is to allow students that have been brought here as kids and have lived here for 5 years or more, and they are good students and residents, and they would be allowed to be on a path to citizenship.
So in 2001, you were all set to testify at a Senate hearing for the DREAM Act, right? But then that stopped. What happened?
That's right. So the Senate hearing was specifically on September 12th, 2001. And we had 60 votes lined up, and
wow.
The DREAM Act was going to pass, and it would have even overridden a president's veto. You know, it would have passed. 60 votes was it. And we were so excited, and we were getting ready to fly over to D.C. the day before, which turned out to be 9/11, a tragic day, and all the flights were canceled. The hearing the next day was canceled, and anything friendly towards immigrant rights was also turned down upon, and people had more animosity towards anything immigrant-friendly towards immigrants after that day. So the DREAM Act was reintroduced, actually, in 2003, but it failed 2005, 2007, along with the Pentagon, because they needed people in the war in Iraq, and then 2010, and constantly there was just no hope for the DREAM Act. And today we have the DREAM Act reintroduced in the summer of 2017.
So what's it been like all of those years to see this legislation come back and then go away, come back and go away while people's lives are in limbo?
Well, it's been quite a roller coaster, up and down and up and down. And sometimes there was more hope and sometimes there was less. And the way we had to be was just to continue on with our everyday lives. And that was very difficult, knowing that we were undocumented. And because you didn't have a certain piece of paperwork, you couldn't drive, you couldn't get work, you couldn't go to school, etc. You basically didn't have any rights as a human being in your own home country.
Mm-hmm. I read that you actually became an American citizen yourself through marriage back in December 2010, and it was just a day after one of the times the DREAM Act failed in Congress.
Yes.
What were you feeling at that point? Yeah.
It was extremely bittersweet. When I got my citizenship, I was in tears. I couldn't stop crying for a long time because that piece of paper I was holding up had so much power in my life.
And you had been waiting for all these years to figure out what closure might kind of feel like, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I would call it closure, but that paperwork meant that I was able to live and get a job and go to college and vote.
Where are you living these days? Where do you work? Tell us what you're doing right now. Or as much
right
as you're
now,
comfortable with, I'll say.
Yes, absolutely. Right now, I have two little kids, 1 and 3 years old, and I'm finishing up my doctorate at Manhattan School of Music.
Congratulations.
Thank you. And I have been active in my local neighborhood working on immigrant rights and also pushing for a statewide legislation called Liberty Act. And we created a group called Liberty Act Coalition that worked tirelessly day and night to push for the Liberty Act, a legislation in New York State that would make New York a sanctuary state. And just last Friday, actually, Governor Cuomo announced an executive order, number 170, stating that New York would be sanctuary by limiting cooperation between local and federal agents. So that was part victory on our part.
Yeah, and I'm sure it's probably rewarding to see your work paying off, at least on the state level.
Yes.
So what are you doing right now to stand up for immigrant rights?
Well, we're trying to get people to make phone calls to their congressmen and women and senators, asking them to co-sponsor the DREAM Act. We have representatives, House members, away from it passing the House before it gets to the Senate. And we hope that we'll actually have a chance at passing this time. Although a lot of people have become cynical over the years, as you can imagine.
Sure. What do you think it will take to finally get this passed now in the complicated climate that we're in?
Well, complicated is correct. And it looks like they are making some deals with, if Trump signs the DREAM Act, there would be some massive raids also being planned.
Mm-hmm.
And our message to Congress is to pass a clean DREAM Act without any dealings on the side.
And can you say a little bit more about what you mean as the clean DREAM Act?
Clean as in just pass the DREAM Act and let's not add on 100,000 massive raids.
Mm-hmm. And can you tell me about some of the people and maybe if you've met some inspiring women along the way, who are some of the people that you've met in your advocacy that maybe stick in your mind?
Oh, absolutely. One of the first DREAMers to come out, actually, Tam Tran. She was tragically killed in a car accident a few years ago. She was the first to come out to speak in public forums and churches and talk about how she was undocumented and letting her neighbors know that undocumented people are all around them.
Mm-hmm.
Gabby Pacheco from Florida, she and her family experienced raids in the middle of the night, 4 in the morning. And she, along with 3 other DREAMers, they decided to walk from Florida on foot all the way to Washington, D.C. to advocate for the DREAM Act.
Oh, my gosh.
Yes. And there's also Erica Andiola from Arizona. Her family has also experienced raids, and she's been organizing and working tirelessly for years in Arizona and in D.C. right now. She's currently in D.C. advocating for immigrant rights.
They sound like amazing women, all of them. And I know that you've also done, you've stood up in the face of incredibly difficult circumstances. So thank you for that, because I'm sure you've inspired so many people. So for people who aren't sure if they support protections like the DREAM Act today, what would you say that could maybe convince them or change their minds?
Well, one thing that people should understand is that our parents loved us as you would love your children. And all they wanted to do was to help us to get a better life, to get a better education somewhere instead of a war zone, a third world country, or somewhere where they are escaping rape or other crimes. We're like any migrants, we're just trying to get a better life somewhere. And this country has been a refuge for centuries, and the law is an old one. It's an old one. The way it is right now, it doesn't stand up to what we need today.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned earlier that you're a mother now. You have two small children. Has that at all changed how you viewed the decision your parents were faced with when you were 2 years old?
I can't imagine the environment they were in and what they were going through to have made those very difficult decisions to move and start over.
I read that, unfortunately, your father passed away a few years back. What does your mother have to say about what's going on right now?
Like many undocumented Americans, she also is cynical, but there's a glimmer of hope here and there, and we just have to keep on going about our daily lives.
Exactly right. Okay, Teresa, each episode we do what we call the Mini Love Bomb Guide, and it's for listeners to get some real-world, everyday tips for doing good and helping out. So I've got three final questions for you, okay?
Sure.
All right, number one, what can people do today, right now, to stand up for Dreamers?
You can call your representatives and your senators and ask them to co-sponsor the DREAM Act.
Perfect. And what do you think is the most important thing right now? Is it, you know, making calls? Is it giving money? Is it demonstrating? Is it all of it? What's the most important thing?
It's to be there. It's to be there. If there is a demonstration, be there. If there's a phone call that needs to be made, then do it. If someone is experiencing a raid, you have to respond to it. You just have to be there and do it.
Be there and do it. That's good advice.
Yes.
Kind of on a similar note, what is the best way for someone to be an ally and an advocate if they know someone that's undocumented who's probably feeling incredibly scared right now?
It's a tricky question because the bottom line is that we're all people. We're all human beings, and we want to be treated like human beings. You wouldn't know that somebody is undocumented by looking at them. And so you treat them the same way that you would any other person, yourself. And we just have to make sure that we can create an environment in our neighborhoods, in your churches, or, you know, in neighborhood settings mm-hmm. to provide a safe space for those that might need it, like a sanctuary space in churches.
We've got some work to do, Teresa. Thank you so much for sharing your story and for keeping up the fight.
Yes, thank you so much.
That was Teresa Lee, one of the original Dreamers who inspired the DREAM Act to go before the Senate in 2001. To find out more, check out United We Dream at unitedwedream.org. That's it for Ladies Who Love Bomb this week. I'm your host, Jill Hilbrenner. Our producer is Justine Dom. Alex Laughlin is our digital editor, and original artwork is by Michael Thompson. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts. You can find us at ladieswholovebomb.com, on Facebook and Instagram at ladieswholovebomb, and in your earbuds every other week. Until next time, be nice to your fellow humans. Lots of love.